School students. Would they stand, please? Good to have you with us this morning. You may be seated. The students are here with a program titled Court with Class. It's a national award-winning program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. The students around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if they agree to come, they're sent briefs of the case, and they may have engaged in a variety of activities relating to this case. And as part of the program, they will attend a session after the second case with the justice of this court. That session deals with the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case we are about to hear. Everyone is welcome to join with the students at that noon session. Let me introduce the court to each of you. Starting on the left is Justice Lewis Butler. Next to him is Justice David Prosser. On my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you will meet at noon. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Pat Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case this morning, 048P0548W, State Ex Rel Marvin Coleman versus Gary R. McGoldrick. Arguing on behalf of the petitioner Marvin Coleman is Brian Kinsler. Counselor Kinsler.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Brian Kinsler, and I represent the petitioner Marvin Coleman, who is presently a prisoner at the Red Granite Correctional Institute in Red Granite, Wisconsin. Mr. Coleman was convicted in 1986 of several serious felony counts. Trial counsel filed and argued a suppression motion challenging the admissibility of evidence and statements in the case. That motion was denied by the Rock County Circuit Court, and Coleman subsequently pled guilty and was sentenced to 80 years in prison. At issue in this case is whether Mr. Coleman's direct appellate rights should be reinstated as a consequence of his appointed counsel's, that is, his appointed appellate counsel's failure to recognize a significant and obvious issue of merit and to raise that issue on appeal on behalf of Mr. Coleman. The record in this case, I think, raises one issue that can be split up into, I think, three different versions of an approach to handling the latches problem, and I do believe it is a problem. I think that the case of Smalley versus Morgan presents some significant impediments to due process for Knight petitioners, state habeas petitioners, in that neither a hearing on the unreasonableness of their delay or on the prejudice caused to the state seems to be necessary under that case, and for that reason we're asking that it be reversed. Additionally, Coleman believes that, there are three versions of Coleman's position. I can characterize them as sort of the strong hypothesis, the weak hypothesis, and the middle ground. The strong hypothesis, our first argument, is that latches should not apply to a Knight petition as a matter of principle. That is, ineffective assistance of counsel is imputed to the state. Latches effectively shifts the burden to a defendant who, ironically, no longer has the right to counsel and frequently cannot afford counsel. I think it's more ironic that the application of latches essentially penalizes the defendant for not knowing better than his appellate counsel. The second version, the middle ground, is that latches certainly should not apply to cases where, as here, the defendant is essentially denied appellate counsel altogether under the standards set forth in Roe v. Flores-Ortega or in Penson v. Ohio, similar to what the Supreme Court described in Cronic, the United States Supreme Court, that is, in which appellate counsel essentially abandoned his client and, without proper waiver, failed to file an appeal and vindicate his appellate rights. Under that set of circumstances, I think both state and federal case law agrees. Prejudice is presumed. If prejudice is presumed, then the current scheme puts the defendant in the following position. They are not permitted to show that prejudice is presumed. That is, the court procedurally won't deal with the issue. On the other hand, before the court realizes or even attempts to determine whether prejudice is presumed, the defendant has to show that the state is not prejudiced. This puts the cart before the horse. The problem here is that the state can never be prejudiced by appellate counsel's failing. The defendant is per se entitled to reinstatement of his or her direct appellate rights.
I understand why the state can never be prejudiced.
Let's take the case in front of the court. Here we have an example where, and I'll ask the court to indulge the following assumption. Appellate counsel did not recognize a significant and obvious meritorious issue and told Mr. Coleman that nothing could be done. Whatever reason appellate counsel had, if he forgot it, if he did research and it told him he was not able to pursue this issue, if a colleague told him there was no way it could happen, any of those reasons, none of them should be sufficient to overcome the fact that case law at that time said that it was a significant and obvious issue of merit.
But did case law at that time say it was a significant and obvious issue of merit? If I understand the issue correctly, the case law you're referring to is Minnesota versus Olson, correct?
Not necessarily. I think Minnesota.
Were there other cases besides Olson?
I think there were an abundance of cases at the time that spelled out that a person need not live in a, need not name a place as his or her residence in order to have standing. I don't think that the Minnesota v. Olson case is necessary to a determination that there's a significant issue. I think it's fairly clear from the record that, I think it's fairly clear from the record that under almost any analysis, as far back as I have done the research, and I've seen cases well into the 1950s that deal with such issues, the mere fact that someone does not name a place as his residence does not require...
Let me just ask another question. What comes first here? Do we have to first say he's got a meritorious defense that... at least would have been worthy of appeal? Do we have to say he would have won and then we get to latches? Or do we first say, look, it's been, 17, 18 years, whatever number of years it is here, and that's just too late to go back, even assuming there was ineffective assistance of counsel? So what's the analytical framework here?
I think that all systems, especially the post-conviction system, all systems have gaps, all systems leak. And I think that this is one particular area of post-conviction law in Wisconsin where there are contradictions that are inherent. For example, courts typically like to take care of procedural issues before they reach substantive ones. If they can dismiss a case on procedural grounds, that's the way to go. In this case, the Court of Appeals, and I think current procedure assumes that latches is the procedural issue that must be dealt with first. I don't think that's actually correct. I think analytically, the ineffective assistance of counsel claim is a procedural issue. That's what ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims are.
You have to prove that counsel was didn't fulfill a reasonable attorney under those circumstances, and there was prejudice to your client. Is that right?
That's
the ineffective. That's Strickland.
You're talking about Strickland.
Well, yes and no. Strickland or Cronic, either could apply. I don't mean to make a false distinction between the two, but I think that there's a significant difference between cases. And if the Court wants to recognize that procedurally, I think that might be appropriate. There's a substantial difference between a circumstance in which an appellate attorney raises certain issues but doesn't raise the one the petitioner wanted, and a circumstance in which, like Cronic, like Roe versus Flores Ortega, like Penson v. Ohio, where the appeal was abandoned and in which prejudice must be presumed.
But what you're saying, just so I think what you're saying, if you get over the Strickland, the prejudice and the deficiency, then it doesn't make any difference because your client lost his opportunity and therefore latches would I mean, regardless of what the state argues, whether they're prejudiced or not, you'll have an opportunity to go forward. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think under that set of facts, the petitioner should have his or her appellate rights reinstated.
Counsel, the Chief asked what goes first in the analytical framework. In my mind, what goes first is the question of whether latches is available constitutionally in this kind of a habeas corpus action. Because I say, why do you start with ineffective assistance of counsel? And besides that, maybe there are questions of fact. I mean, the state even suggests that maybe, depending on how this plays out, that a remand could be necessary. That is, that maybe the Court of Appeals opinion did a little fact-finding here. So why, in response to the Chief's question, why isn't the answer that the first step in the analysis is whether or not latches is even available as a defense?
Well,
my question is, just a repetition of first, what's the first step in the analysis? What do you have to look at first?
We think, based on fairly fundamental principles, that latches should not apply to a Knight petition in the first place. And that is because, again, responsibility, the burden for ineffective assistance of counsel is imputed to the state.
So is the answer to my question, the first issue we address is latches, or is that not the answer to my question?
No, that is not the answer to the question. But I think we're operating on two or three different theories of how this Court could proceed. We feel that latches represents a fundamental problem to due process rights of an appellant, in that it shifts the burden impermissibly to a defendant. Latches is a defense, and latches is typically a defense against a substantive claim. Here, latches is being applied to a procedural claim. That's what ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims are. And I just don't see it appropriate in that context. If the Court is not prepared to abandon the application of latches, we suggest that the Court of Appeals, whatever court is considering a Knight petition, obviously it's the Court of Appeals, has to first evaluate whether or not this is the type of issue that is amenable to latches. That is, should latches, is this the type of case in which abandonment took place and which prejudice may be presumed, or is this the type of case that may require a closer analysis and possibly response by appellate counsel? Obviously, if appellate counsel isn't around anymore, that presents certain problems, but that does not foreclose a fair determination by the Court of whether or not ineffective assistance of appellate counsel existed. It simply removes some of the facts from the calculation. Secondly, you know, it's not entirely clear what the Court should do when it makes the latches determination. And I think that remand should be required in all cases where a Knight petition meets with a claim of defense.
Remand to whom? Remand to whom?
Well, remand to the Circuit Court for a fact-finding. Obviously, the problem in this case is that the Court of Appeals is not a fact-finding court. It doesn't have the resources to do so, and I don't think it necessarily in this case presented Mr. Coleman with an appropriate opportunity for that fact-finding. Again, as we stated, I believe, in our reply brief, knowing that latches had been raised, Mr. Coleman fully anticipated that there would be a hearing on this issue. Our pleadings to the court are not evidence, and there was no reason to believe that we could fully plead as many facts as would satisfy the Court of Appeals in determining whether or not latches should apply. I should also point out that Mr. Coleman is uncommon among Knight petitioners in that he has the money to afford counsel. I'm not sure that it isn't an unreasonable burden to place on an indigent Knight petitioner the task of fully outlining the entire factual basis for a defense of latches in his petition before the state even raises that defense. So I think there are problems with it from that aspect as well, and that's why I think that in cases where the state asserts latches as a defense, remand should be automatic to a circuit court for a fact-finding. There may be cases in which that is a waste of time. I don't presume to know when that will be. But I think, given the gravity of the issue, that's the very least that this Court should do in order to guarantee that if latches is going to be allowed to apply to Knight petitions, that it's applied correctly. The Court of Appeals
has, I'm sorry, latches has several elements to it, right, or factors.
I would certainly agree.
And as I read the state's brief, at least they agreed as to one of those factors there should be fact-finding. I think it was as to prejudice to the state, if I'm right. But what factors do you want fact-finding on?
Well, I certainly want fact-finding on the two prongs that the Court of Appeals addressed in the first place. I do think that there's potentially a third factor, and that has
first
to do...
First, give us the two factors that you think the Court of Appeals did.
Well, the Court of Appeals determined that the delay was unreasonable.
Okay.
And the Court of Appeals determined, without factual basis, that the state was prejudiced by that delay.
All right. What factor do you want? What's the third factor?
The third factor is whether or not the state had reasonable notice. I think that there are circumstances in which it should be fairly clear, such as the filing of a notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief, where the state should be deemed to have had notice. And I think that happened in this case. It may be a technical issue because I don't think it necessarily relates to the issue in this case. But I do think the Court should take this opportunity to clarify if it is going to continue to apply latches to Knight petitions, precisely what the analysis should be.
Counsel, when you're talking about reasonable notice, are you talking about notice of the standing issue, notice of a consent issue, or what specifically are you talking about?
Well, that's an interesting question because we have two levels of issue here that the state would have to have notice of. I don't see how an appellant or a petitioner could possibly give notice to the state in advance that he, and I don't mean to make it sound like a self-fulfilling prophecy, I don't think it's possible that a petitioner could know that they're about to receive the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. I think the notice that's required is the notice that the petitioner intends to pursue some form of post-conviction relief by preserving a substantial issue, either pretrial or in post-conviction pleadings. I think that's what happened in this case.
Now, you're getting that factor, as I understand it, not from the cases on the criminal side that have applied latches, but you're getting it from cases that you claim are applicable on the civil side because this is habeas corpus?
I'm not taking them for that reason. I think that many of the cases that have been decided on the criminal side have been given short shrift, and I think, like Smalley versus Morgan, have given the real requirements short shrift, including the requirement of a fact-finding. But because it is an equitable doctrine, I do think it's appropriate to draw from either criminal or civil. I think that's consistent with other doctrines that the Court's drawn into habeas.
Thank you.
You and the State agree, then, on the Lajes test, the three, both of you agree that the same three elements?
I can't speak for the State. I do believe that the notice issue is important, but I do believe that that notice issue should be deemed satisfied by circumstances in this case, that is, the filing of a suppression motion and the entry of a guilty plea. There's a more formal way of doing it in some jurisdictions, that is, entering a so-called conditional guilty plea.
Well, page 19 of the State's brief sets out the same three factors that you set out, citing Sawyer versus Middleford. So that's what causes me to assert that, based on their brief, they seem to be in accord with the same three factors on page 19 of their red brief as you are, I think.
I suppose that's what the State would like. I would say that Mr. Coleman would agree then. In any case, I still feel that there are fundamental problems with application of Lajes in a certain subset of cases. And I think that it's important to recognize what those subset of cases are before a defense is applied that, again, I think puts the court before the cart before the horse.
So your real position, your basic position, Lajes doesn't apply on ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Is that your basic position?
I don't mean to hedge. My basic position is that with regard to Mr. Coleman, with at least regard to some subset of cases,
well, Lajes
does
subset.
Not apply.
The
subset in which abandonment takes place.
Okay. And abandonment means what?
Where a petitioner has been denied, effectively denied, the assistance of appellate counsel in a manner similar to that which is dealt with in Chronic, the United States.
And what's that?
In Chronic, which was the companion case to Strickland, the United States Supreme Court dealt with an issue involving an attorney who was not trained in criminal law, who was a young bankruptcy attorney, and who was appointed counsel on a complex federal white-collar case involving tens of thousands of pages of discovery and issues that that attorney had never dealt with 1 month prior to trial to prepare. In that case, the court considered the other side of the same coin. Under certain circumstances, there is no way we can expect counsel to function. And in those cases, when counsel is not just merely below a certain constitutional level of competency, but is effectively unable to represent his client or her client at all.
Well, that isn't what happened here, is it? I mean, I'm looking at the correspondence. Just correlate that to this case.
Well, I can correlate it in a more simple fashion because the United States Supreme Court has already done that in Roe versus Flores-Ortega, where they adopted the same principle of Chronic to appellate ineffective assistance of counsel. It basically adopted the same holding that under circumstances of abandonment, whatever the state post-conviction procedure happens to be, where there's abandonment, where somebody has effectively been, where their appellate right has been forfeited, it's important to recognize that under the same principles as apply in Chronic, prejudice is presumed. There is no defense that the
prejudice
state...
Prejudice to whom? The defendant.
Prejudice to the defendant is presumed. There is no defense that the state can put forward under those circumstances.
Let me just follow up on that point because I want to understand exactly where your distinction lies. For purposes of this case here, if appellate counsel had filed a notice of appeal and raised two other issues but neglected to raise this issue, Is it your position that latches would then apply or would not apply?
It would be our position that latches should not apply at all. However, it would be less...
Because you don't really have an abandonment situation there.
You just have
ineffective assistance, arguably.
If it were to apply, it should still apply. How does one know if latches applies unless one considers the abandonment issue? I don't think the abandonment issue is necessarily a pure issue. I think there are circumstances in which appellate counsel can file an appeal on two completely frivolous issues and miss the dead bang winner. In circumstances like that, or in circumstances where it's briefed inappropriately, I think the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel can also fall to that level that is not just ineffective, but essentially constitutes a denial of the assistance of counsel. So I think it's important to review the claim of ineffective assistance first to determine whether prejudice should be presumed before one decides whether or not to apply latches in case it is not presumed.
Counsel, give me an example of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel that doesn't constitute abandonment. It's the other side of the question that Justice Butler has been asking you.
Well, I think it's very close to the suggestion of Justice Butler. That is, counsel files an appeal on one or two issues and decides not to pursue an appeal on a third issue. And that third issue, either because of his or her lack of knowledge about recent case law, turns out to be not just a substantial issue, but really the one that was clearly more appropriate.
Is that abandonment, or is that just ineffective assistance of counsel?
That's not abandonment. That is ineffective. The question, I think the finer question is it, do we presume prejudice? Abandonment is one type of case in which we presume prejudice. I don't think it needs to be the only type of case in which we presume prejudice. There are facts that I cannot possibly assume, but I can say that could lead to a determination that somebody was effectively without counsel. Take, for instance, the example of somebody who has appointed counsel who, like the defendant in Chronic, is a bankruptcy attorney who's appealing a three-co-defendant homicide case involving DNA evidence, identification procedures, suppression issues. For that attorney to file an appeal, well, that's not abandonment. But his effectiveness, I see my time is up, but his effectiveness is so severely harmed that that may constitute per se prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. William Gansner, Assistant Attorney General, representing Gary McCautry.
May it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General William Gansner, appearing on behalf of the respondents in this matter. Let me address, from the State's viewpoint, the most important matter first. There's no dispute in this case that a person who claims a denial of the effective assistance of appellate counsel, or who claims the denial of counsel on appeal by virtue of abandonment by his or her attorney, is entitled to a procedure and a forum under Wisconsin law in which the defendant may assert that claim. This Court made that amply clear when it so held in Knight. And there is no dispute between the parties here that that is the law. The dispute here is over whether, and I will address in a moment the significant distinction between claims of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel and abandonment of counsel. But the question in this case is whether or not that claim, which was asserted by Mr. Coleman many years after the events about which he complains, was asserted too late. Yes, an individual should be entitled to a forum and a procedure by which to assert the claim that I was denied the effective assistance of appellate counsel or my client, my attorney abandoned me, but that is only the assertion of the claim. It gets you into a forum. It is a procedure by which to raise it. The question then becomes, in Wisconsin, since the procedure is set forth in Knight, and this Court determined in that case that the procedure for asserting ineffectiveness of appellate counsel as opposed to ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel for failing or negligently or insufficiently doing things in the circuit court on post-conviction motion, this Court held that the forum for the claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel was in the Court of Appeals on a Knight petition, and because habeas corpus, the remedy in Knight, is an equitable remedy, it has been recognized since that time, as reflected in the Court of Appeals decision that has followed throughout the state of State X Rel Smalley versus Morgan, that the equitable doctrine of latches should apply to such claims, habeas claims, of I was denied my right to the effective assistance of counsel or that I was abandoned. So the first question in this case, in our view, that was raised here, and that I believe this Court took this case to examine, is whether my opponent is correct in saying that latches should never be applied. The doctrine of latches simply should never be applied to claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. As I understand it, it is Mr. Kinstler's argument that this Court should declare, apparently as a matter of constitutional law, but it's a little unclear to me what the basis of his argument is, that this Court should declare that latches, this equitable doctrine that clearly applies under well-established case law in this state and elsewhere, that the equitable doctrine of latches should apply to the equitable remedy of habeas corpus, his contention is it simply should not. So that thus there would be, I think the answer would be, but, well, Mr. Kinstler, are you saying that there is no time limit after which an individual can bring such a claim? I suspect Mr. Kinstler would say that the defendant can bring it as long as he's in custody, however long that might be. But that even if a period of time so long that all memory or records of what had happened were gone, it is apparently Mr. Kinstler's view that latches should not be applied. And we think that's simply an unreasonable view to take.
Counsel, do you read the brief of your opposing counsel to advance the argument that latches is never available in a Knight petition?
Well, I must say, I'm not sure that I read his brief that way, but that's apparently what Mr. Kinstler is arguing here. And as I say, I'm not sure that I read his brief that way, and if I failed to read it that way and that's what it says, then that's my failing. But that's apparently his argument here today, and if that is his argument, as it appears to be, we're against it. We don't think that's right. The equitable doctrine of latches ought to apply to the equitable remedy of habeas corpus. There surely must be some repose, some point at which, and there can be, and these will be fact-specific, circumstances in which it will simply be impossible for the responding party to address the claim that's being raised. Now, some might say that is effectively what legislatures do when they create statutes of limitation. We, the state, looked at this issue in terms of, well, is there some black-letter law that says beyond a certain period of time, habeas corpus should not lie? And I will tell you, we don't have an answer for that, because I don't think this is something that is susceptible, or at least not in terms of an argument that we felt appropriate to present, but there is a time beyond which it can be said that it is so clearly the case that the ability of people to respond to a claim would be destroyed, that a line should be written. If the legislature wishes to create a statute of limitations for asserting filing a petition for a writ of habeas corpus, it can do so. This Court, in its rulemaking authority, created all kinds of rules in Supreme Court Rule 72 about how long records should be maintained by courts. And I know, just anecdotally, that records are to be retained by circuit courts in felony cases for 50 years or 75 years if they're Class A felonies. There's a long period of time that the courts of this state are told to maintain records. In this case, we have a question not of a court, but I think that the real factual dispute in this case, and a reason why we have suggested to this Court that this may be an appropriate case for this Court to consider a remand to address what we think is the elements of latches, a doctrine that should be applied here. The question is whether or not the appointed attorney has the ability to reconstruct, or a court has the ability to have evidence presented to it from which it can determine what did happen but 17 years ago.
But, Mr. Ganson, don't we have, and I don't want to put word in opposing counsel's mouth here, but isn't there another issue that's underlying at least the facts of this case, not necessarily all-night petitions, but in this case, as I understand it, the argument is that by depriving Mr. Coleman of the right to counsel in this case, that necessarily also deprives him of his right to an appeal. So what you've got in a habeas setting is a person who's alleging I'm in custody illegally. Here's a guy who's saying, not only do I have ineffective assistance of counsel, I never got the appeal that it was real clear that I wanted. And should, and I guess my question to you is, should latches apply when the right to appeal is arguably denied?
Okay. Our view is yes, and this leads me directly, Mr. Joseph Butler, to the distinction that I think it is relevant, and this Court, some questions were asked about this, about what the difference is between a claim of abandonment of appellate counsel and a claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. I think the best way to keep these matters clear is to view the archetypal examples of each. Abandonment, as I understand the term, and as I think the cases have discussed it, involves a defendant who wishes to take an appeal, advises his attorney that he does wish to do so, but the attorney does not do so. The attorney literally drops or abandons the client, takes no action, files no notice of appeal, or files a notice of appeal and then proceeds no further, does not proceed to complete the appellate process, nor does the attorney use the no-merit procedure, just simply drops the defendant.
And do we have that here?
Do we have that here?
No.
It's not clear that that's what we hear, that that's what we have here. It's because we're not certain what the facts are. If I can just conclude, in the abandonment area, this Court said in Flores that what you may have, what may seem to be an abandonment, nothing was done, was in fact a waiver of the appeal, because the defendant, there may be cases in which the appellate attorney, the slash post-conviction appellate attorney, discusses with his client whether or not an appeal would have merit, discusses with the client the options that are available to the client. I can file a no-merit report. You can contest it. I can proceed with an appeal, although I'm telling you I don't think an appeal would have any merit, and I don't think an appeal should proceed. You can proceed on your own, aware of the risks of proceeding pro se without representation. And there are circumstances in which, and Flores was such a case, in which this Court said, a defendant, knowing all of that, could knowingly, intentionally, voluntarily relinquish his right to an appeal. I don't know if that's what happened in this case. We simply don't know enough. We've got three documents presented, letters presented, that the petitioner presented in his habeas petition in the circuit court, from counsel, from appointed appellate counsel to the defendant, one of them saying, I write to affirm an agreement we reached on May 29, 1987. I told you I thought you had no chance of obtaining any relief on appeal. You accepted my view and indicated that you did not want to pursue an appeal. Good luck to you. A year later, Mr. Coleman wrote to the attorney and said, I'd like the transcripts. I'd like you to give them to me so that I can do the research that you failed to do on an appeal or a post-conviction motion. Please do not close my appeal if a deadline has not already occurred. Those two letters by themselves create ambiguity as to precisely what happened. We have a defense attorney in May of 1987 writing a letter memorializing what defense counsel said was, what appellate counsel said was, the agreement that they had reached that the defendant did not wish to pursue an appeal. A year later, we have an ambiguity creating conflicting statement letter coming from the defendant saying, wait a minute, I wanted an appeal, or you didn't pursue it. Send the stuff to me. It indicates he wants to proceed, and it's suggesting that if defense counsel won't do it for him, he'll do it on his own. But we don't know what he knew about self-representation and what he had been advised.
Was the defendant's letter to his attorney within the time limits for filing the appeal?
It was, I think, it surely was outside the time limits of 8 or 9:30. Well, I can't be absolutely certain because, of course, the time limit for filing a motion under 8 or 9:30 depends upon when the transcripts become available. Because we have that system, we have that rule that says get your ducks in line before you make your motion or file an appeal, get the transcripts prepared. There's always some degree of indefiniteness here. We'd have to check the record.
You did have a post-conviction motion in this case,
yeah.
However, for its
yes,
modification.
There was a motion for sentence modification.
That was denied in May of 87?
Yes. So if the proper procedures were followed and the transcripts were available before a post-conviction counsel filed that motion, then yes, the transcripts would have been filed, and the action that we've described in the letters here, that Mr. Coleman's letter back to the attorney a year later, would have been beyond the time for pursuing an appeal.
Is there...
That is probably the case, but I cannot speak with absolute certainty because it's conceivable that the sentence modification motion may have been filed before all the transcripts came in. I simply don't know. But I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did not mean to interrupt.
Well, we've been talking about the difference between abandonment and ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right.
So abandonment is no appeal, no completed appeal.
It dropped.
And the client has not consented or waived.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And in that case, this Court has recognized what the United States Supreme Court has long held is that the defendant, in a case of abandonment, I wanted to take an appeal. I didn't waive it. My attorney didn't do it. In a state in which there is a right to a first appeal, to a direct appeal as of right, as in Wisconsin there is by Constitution, then that clear case of abandonment, non-waiver of the right to appeal, in that circumstance, the defendant does not have to prove any prejudice. The defendant does not have to prove I had a meritorious claim that I wanted to raise. Prejudice is either, depending upon how you describe it, either presumed or it doesn't have to be proved. In essence, the prejudice is I didn't get my right to an appeal.
You didn't get your right to counsel on appeal.
And it resulted in no appeal at all, and thus the loss of my right to appeal. Ineffective assistance.
You don't have to show you would have won on an appeal.
No, okay. No, because what you have in fact lost is the right to make any argument on appeal. And if you're in a state like Wisconsin where you have a constitutional statutory right to an appeal, that's an important right. ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, I think, in the archetypical circumstances, are circumstances in which an appeal is taken and the defendant later claims, my attorney didn't argue the right issues. He should have argued issue A and B instead of C and D, or he argued issues A, B, C, and D, but he didn't argue them very well. He didn't argue the controlling authority. He didn't act effectively. Those are, like other claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, trial counsel, or at the post-conviction level, I think are clearly subject, as this Court has held, to the Strickland versus Washington deficient performance and prejudice test.
Does Latches apply to both abandonment and ineffective assistance in your opinion?
Yes. In our opinion, it does, because, for the simple reason, Your Honor, that as long as habeas corpus is the remedy for challenging either abandonment or ineffective assistance of counsel, the absolute denial of the right to counsel or the absence of effective performance by counsel, as long as the vehicle for asserting that claim is habeas corpus, then yes, the equitable doctrine of Latches ought to apply, number one, because we think that's well-established case law, but two, because it makes simply good sense that there can be circumstances in which the delay was so long and so unreasonable and prejudice to the state's ability to respond to the claim of ineffective assistance or abandonment is so clear that it would be unjust for the claim to proceed. That under those circumstances, a court should reasonably conclude this defendant simply waited too long.
Okay, now you're
saying. Now, the question is whether that's the case here, and we think the facts aren't clear. That's why we've suggested the case ought to be remanded.
So the prejudice to the state is not that it might not be able to prove the felonies again because of loss of witnesses, witnesses' memory, witnesses died, et cetera. That isn't the prejudice here.
You could go through three levels of prejudice here, and I think it takes it too far to go as far as, in all fairness, I think it takes it too far to suggest, as the Court of Appeals did here, that if the defendant had his appeal reinstated, and if the defendant won on the appeal on his suppression issue and got a new trial, the state might not be able to retry him. That third level of prejudice here, let's keep in mind, I mean, the state's obligation here is to zealously prosecute cases, but to also be fair. Our obligation to govern impartially, as the United States Supreme Court once said, is as important as the obligation to govern at all. In our view, to go to that third level of prejudice and say, if a defendant has won, gets a right to an appeal, is then successful on appeal and gets a new trial, that to say this, he shouldn't be allowed to do all of that because the state might not have the means to retry him this much later.
Okay.
I think that takes it too far. I don't know if that's true in this case. I think we do know in this case that the second level.
Wait, give me those three levels.
Okay. Well, the first level, I think, and this is where I think Latches applies. The question is the state prejudice in its ability to respond to the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim? Mr. Coleman files a habeas petition saying either I was abandoned, counsel abandoned me, or I did not receive effective representation by my counsel. First question is under Latches, under the three elements, was there an unreasonable delay? Did the state have notice? Has the state been prejudiced in its ability to respond? Is, I think it's clearly the case that prejudice there refers to the ability to respond to the claim that the defendant has made, ineffective assistance of counsel. The next level of
answer the Chief's question first.
Well, now, I suppose the next level of prejudice would be if the defendant has his or her right to a direct appeal reinstated, is the state prejudiced by the passage of time in its ability to respond to the appeal, to the reinstated appeal? Frankly, I think I'm just out, I think I'm just creating the three layers. I kind of feel a little bit like a geologist here, but are you prejudiced in your ability to respond to the ineffective claim? Are you prejudiced in your ability to respond to the appeal if the defendant wins his ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim? And then prejudice, if he wins his ineffective assistance of counsel claim and gets a new appeal, has a new appeal, wins, gets a new trial, is the state prejudiced in its ability to retry? That would be the third level. I think that what the doctrine of latches is meant to say to us here, first of all, is you apply the prejudice prong of the latches principle to the initial question of can the state, has the state been prejudiced in its ability to respond to the ineffective claim?
Now,
I think it takes it too far to reach the third claim, and I don't think we need to reach it here. And with respect to has the state been prejudiced in this case in its ability to respond to an appeal, if Mr. Coleman were to have his appeal rights reinstated, it appears that we have, assuming that the records still exist, that the Dane County Circuit Court has followed this Court's rule and has kept all of the records, that we have an appeal that could go forward on the transcripts that existed then, just as, presumably, had an appeal not been waived or, for whatever reason, it wasn't taken back then, an appeal could have proceeded in 1987 or 1988.
But I want to take it back to the first layer and the argument about unreasonable delay. And I think, as I understand the state's position, and maybe I'm overreading it, it's pretty much that, look, we're dealing with 17 years here. How can we resurrect this stuff? It's just too long. But is it an unreasonable delay when a person has been deprived of assistance of counsel?
I understand the question. My response to that question would be simple. If there had been no means for this defendant to complain, assert his rights, seek to obtain relief, other than with the assistance of the one and only appointed counsel that he had in the intervening 17 years. I think we know in Wisconsin that that is not the case. Yes, he was deprived of an attorney, he was deprived of an attorney. He didn't have an attorney. He didn't have an attorney who took an appeal, or an appeal wasn't taken. Whether Mr. Coleman waived the right to appeal or was abandoned is something we don't know at this point because we don't have good enough facts. We've got some evidentiary indications going both ways, but the record is equivocal. And it's ambiguous. But did he have other means of attempting to vindicate what he claimed was a meritorious Fourth Amendment argument? Yes. We know, and this, as the circuit court said, this state clearly know, and as the Court of Appeals knows, and as this court eventually sees in many cases, that there are numerous instances in which pro se 97406 motions or pro se habeas corpus petitions are filed by inmates who, for whatever reason, are proceeding without counsel in seeking some kind of collateral relief. We don't have, in this case, Justice Butler, any record or indication from this defendant of why none of the other potential remedies for asserting his right or raising a claim that I need an attorney, I want to file a motion, I want to file a petition, or here's my petition. We don't know why this defendant did not do anything, why he, to use the cliche expression, apparently sat on his rights for 17 years until, apparently through marriage, he obtained the wherewithal to hire an attorney. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of inmates in this state who do not wait for marriage or for the discovery of additional funds before bringing habeas petitions or 97406 motions.
Counsel, let me...
I think he had means available.
Let me make sure I understand, then, your position. Facts here are unclear. But if there is abandonment, mm-hmm.
you agree with the defendant that there is prejudice per se. However, it seems to me, even though you agree with that, you say latches can still be a defense in an appropriate case.
Right.
Is that right?
So, yes.
I mean, usually when there is an agreement that something is prejudice per se, I say, okay, stop. That's it. You don't go any further if there is prejudice per se, because either it is prejudicial per se or it isn't. But I heard you saying earlier that you agree or suggested you agree that if there is abandonment, there is prejudice per se. Mm-hmm. But then you still take another step and say, but even though there's prejudice per se, latches in the appropriate case can apply.
I did not mean to create the appearance of an inconsistency. But it's a perfectly appropriate question, and here's my answer to it. If we know that, I think the distinction is between was there abandonment or was there not abandonment. If the facts clearly show abandonment, and footnote to that, and that means the right to appeal wasn't waived knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily by the defendant. If the facts show abandonment, then the law is perfectly clear. No prejudice has to be shown. The defendant's right to direct appeal should be reinstated. But the question is, has abandonment been proved?
Okay, so.
And latches, delay can interfere with any court's ability to determine whether or not there has been abandonment. There has to be a finding that the defendant wanted, for there to be abandonment, there has to be a finding that the defendant wanted to take an appeal and his attorney, in essence, without waiver of the right to appeal, did not honor his obligations to his client. If the facts show that, abandonment. But if there has been such a long period of delay that those facts cannot be established, we can't determine what happened, then the state has been prejudiced in its ability to respond, and the defendant has waited too long to assert, because there can be no determination of what happened.
Okay, let's just assume under Justice Bradley's question that you've got letters galore and the lawyer admits just didn't do it despite the defendant's persistent every hour on the hour letters and telephones, didn't do it, so there's no question of abandonment. Okay? No question about it.
Undisputed. Now,
pardon me?
Undisputed.
All right. Undisputed. Now we have a situation of latches. First of all, you're not prejudiced. Does latches apply?
Well, I think there's a question would latches apply. If by latches applied, you mean could it be asserted? And I think it wouldn't be asserted.
Okay.
If the facts were perfectly clear,
okay.
Then there would be no reason to assert latches.
But it remains a defense. But you're then saying that the state shouldn't put out a defense because, one, it's not prejudiced in its defense.
That the defense could not be satisfied.
Did the state have reasonable notice after 16 years? What about the other two elements? I understand the prejudice element. What about the other two? Was the delay unreasonable? I think that's where Justice Butler started with you.
Yeah. We think in this case, if we're asking about here, are you talking about your case?
I'm talking about, yes, Justice Bradley's case.
Yeah. The delay might very well have been, in an undisputed case of abandonment,
yes,
the state cannot demonstrate prejudice,
right,
to the claim that I was abandoned because the claim is without dispute,
okay,
established.
Well, that
yet there's
been
unreasonable delay?
Yeah.
Surely there might have been unreasonable delay. But you have to satisfy all of the elements of latches to be successful.
Okay, so once you knock out one, it's gone. The defense is gone.
Okay. Right, under those circumstances, we could not, the state could not assert the defense of latches because on prejudice, you know, we couldn't satisfy.
So you're
prejudiced in our ability to respond to the claim that my attorney abandoned me.
So you're,
it may be unfortunate that you were abandoned, and thus we lose in the sense that you get the right to an appeal, although I don't view that as a loss. It's just a, for the state, it's a reestablishment of your right to pursue an appeal you had a right to take. But we couldn't assert the defense of latches in that case because from the start we knew we couldn't satisfy the prejudice.
It applies, but you can't satisfy one of the factors. Latches always applies. You can't satisfy the factors, so...
That's this court's law. I mean, that's right. And we do agree, I think Mr. Kessler and I do agree, that the elements of latches as set forth in Sawyer versus Middleford are apparently the three elements discussed by this court as recently as 1999 in Sawyer are the three elements. And the law is clear that if you have to satisfy all of them in order for the defense of latches to bar the assertion of a claim.
Now, your opponent, opposing counsel says to remand it back to the circuit court. When I read your brief, are you talking about a remand back to the appellate court?
Well, no, Your Honor. I think as Knight made clear, the Court of Appeals on ineffective assistance, acting on habeas cases on claims of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, retains the authority to refer the case under 752.39 to a referee, a special master, or to remand it to the circuit court. Either of those would be appropriate, and circuit court, it needs to go to a fact finder, whether it's on a reference to a referee or to a circuit court.
Counselor, I have to ask you one question. I got a little lost in the discussion there. My understanding is that there is an agreement between you and opposing counsel that if abandonment is present, that's the end of the story and we don't deal with latches.
Mm-hmm.
But your argument is, well, you may not be able to determine whether there was abandonment or whether there was waiver, and so we're going to send that back for a fact-finding. But at the fact-finding, you can apply latches because the state may not be able to submit proof on that issue one way or the other. Is that right? And if that's the case, why can't we just decide it here?
Because we don't know what the facts are, I think, Your Honor. I think that's a perfectly logical question. And it's a seeming conundrum here, but I think here's the answer to it is, a determination of whether the state has been prejudiced here depends upon some facts that we don't have.
What
more can be discovered, if anything, about what happened in 1987 and 1988, mm-hmm. when we have three letters showing some ambiguity about what happened? By itself, those three letters apparently don't resolve the issue. Is there any further evidence that bears upon this?
What if there's no further evidence? What if what we have before us is all that there is? Does that just apply?
There's our view that that would be a textbook example of a case. If the reason we don't have any more evidence is that the passage of time has made it impossible to find such evidence once existed, mm-hmm. then that, in our view, is a textbook example that would satisfy the element of prejudice of latches. And the defendant, at that point, a court would be fully justified in ruling your delay was unreasonable, which the Court of Appeals already said, and you also, the state has been prejudiced in its ability to respond to your, no court can determine what happened in 1987 and 1988, therefore you have waited too long.
So if we send it back down for this fact finding, we'd also be sending it back down for the trial court to make a determination on whether latches should or should not be applied.
Yeah, this is a situation
This
is a situation in which a determination of what happened in 1987 and 1988,
right.
if it can be completed, will tell us abandonment or no abandonment.
Okay.
But if we can't determine what happened,
right.
then we can't determine whether there was abandonment, waiver or no waiver. And in our view, the doctrine of latches would bar the case from any going any further.
Okay, I understand. And that's where I kind of got lost in the loop. Thanks a lot.
I assume that if this were sent back, that Mr. Faust could be put on the stand and asked about his recollections and any memos in his file or any notes he has to refresh his recollection as to waiver or consent or lack thereof.
There is no question. We know where Mr. Faust is.
I saw him on the street corner this morning.
I sometimes see him outside a couple of times a day.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Ron.
Mr. Kinsler?
I'd like to, if I could, just address a couple of very brief points. First of all,
I do think it's a valid distinction to make between abandonment, that is, where a defendant asks, please appeal, and no appeal is taken. I do think there's a valid distinction between that case and cases where there is a waiver, as in what appears to be the case of Mr. Coleman, where it appears from some correspondence that he agreed with counsel. Certainly, that's a different set of facts, but I think it amounts to the same thing. That is, I think there's no effective difference in that distinction, because a waiver based on ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, that is, based on flawed advice, constitutionally flawed advice, that there is no claim, is being virtually left without appellate counsel just as surely as abandonment is being left without.
Counsel, that rule, if we apply it, takes away ineffective assistance, and every ineffective assistance becomes abandonment.
I'm not sure I agree with that, and for this reason. If counsel tells somebody that they have no claim at all, and it's apparent from the record that there is at least one significant and obvious issue of merit, I think what we can do in that case, I think what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. Here, the Court of Appeals has been applying a presumption of prejudice where it's a very long time and where there's no evidence in the record, at least at a certain point, of attempts to obtain counsel. I think the opposite presumption should apply. I think where there is no appeal and where there is a significant and obvious issue of merit, as here, preserved by a motion and a hearing, that there should be a presumption that whether an appeal was filed or not, whether there was abandonment, or whether the appeal was waived on the basis of bad advice from counsel, I think on any of those circumstances, there should be a presumption that there was a denial of counsel, and prejudice should be presumed.
Your position in this case seems to me that there is no waiver. I'll start again. That the test for waiver under abandonment is whether that waiver was knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently made, and that if it was based on wrong legal advice, it is not a valid waiver.
Yes. I should also say I certainly agree with Mr. Gansner that Knight is unavoidable and that we don't have a statutory system in place, so obviously we're going to have to rely on Knight to determine what to do in cases of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. But I want to say, and I want to be clear about this because I may have sounded a little bit wishy-washy before, and it was part of the give and take. I want to make sure I'm absolutely clear about this. If Latches does not apply, as we think it should not, what's the cost? Latches is not applying to a substantive claim. We're talking about whether a person is going to get a hearing on a claim. If there is an effective assistance of appellate counsel, then they get their appellate rights reinstated. If there is not, based on the record, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, then they do not get their appellate rights reinstated. And if it is unclear, either through the passage of time or the loss of records or transcripts missing or for whatever reason, if the record is insufficient, then reinstatement of someone's appellate rights are appropriate. That is, with limitations such as a person may not pursue an appeal or an appellate issue that was previously pursued. But certainly, we're not talking about a massive number of cases, and we're not talking about giving somebody relief in the form of a new trial. We're simply giving them an avenue. And even if Latches does apply, a similar avenue would be open to them.
Mr. Kinsler, looking at Mr. Gansner's three layers here, I just want to make sure he's focusing on the first layer. There's not really a problem with the second layer. At least I'm asking, is there a problem with the second layer, given the fact that there was a suppression hearing on the issue that wanted to be litigated? In other words, should we get to that point, is there enough of a record to deal with that?
I'm glad you point that out, Justice Butler, and I think in this case we don't have a problem. I think we have transcripts that are more than sufficient to establish a factual basis for an appeal and from which an appeal could have been taken in the first place. So I don't believe that there's an issue with that. And I also agree
that it doesn't need to be a second evidentiary hearing on the underlying issue.
I don't think so. I should say, however, that I agree with Mr. Gansner with regard to the trial prejudice. Certainly, if a new trial is granted, if Mr. Coleman's appellate rights are reinstated, he prevails on appeal and a new trial is granted, then the presumption of innocence applies. And Coleman will be in no different a situation than where the statute of limitations might apply or where the fruits of an illegal search are suppressed. That cannot constitute prejudice under the determination of Laches. But let me, if I may, just very briefly say one final matter, and that is that if Laches does apply, it should only apply to cases after it's determined that the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim is made out and that it's determined that the case does not represent an instance of the constructive denial of counsel, as I think occurred here. Thank you very much.
Well, counsel, thank you, Mr. Gansner, and thank you, Mr. Kinsler, on this argument relating to ineffective assistance at appellate level. That will conclude our hearing in 048-0548-W, Coleman versus McGautry. And the court will take a brief recess, so if the students wish to leave, they may, and new students will come in. Thank you.